This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your state society of CPAs for your personal, non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Request for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the weekly tax update for April 8th, 2013. As has been our recent custom, we're going to quickly review 10 items that are part of this week's program. An internal legal memorandum holding that a book publisher's activities are not quite enough to qualify for the qualified domestic production deduction. A second electronic communication from the chief counsel's office addresses reporting requirements for condemnation payments made to landowners by state agencies. Our third item involves a famous name, AIG, American International Group, in a lawsuit trying to hold on to some tax benefits that now two courts plus a court of appeals have said do not have economic substance. Next, a final report on 1,200 retirement plan questionnaires. It went out in 2008. The IRS has all the replies back, and they've got them all analyzed, and they can tell you a lot about the makeup of 401k plans, who participates, who doesn't, the difference between small plans and large plans. It's a 65-page report with all the footnotes, but interesting reading for those that are involved in 401k planning and operation. Next, the IRS has released new 2013 allowable living expense standards. Those are available at the IRS website. And then another situation where a taxpayer failed to keep proper records, didn't really qualify as a real estate professional, did not make the election to aggregate all the real estate activities, and as a result, lost the real estate professional status, and the activities were deemed to be passive activities, and the taxpayer lost $120,000 in deductions. Then, two letters to the IRS, one from BKD, Baird, Kurtz, and Dobson, in the Midwest here in the United States, commenting on proposed regulations and some questions they have about the new Section 1411 3.8% Medicare tax, and then a letter from a Canadian firm that points to what they believe might be an inconsistency in the treaty and an unintended result in that the provisions of the treaty and the new code section 1411 and its placement in the code would make the 3.8% tax not eligible for a foreign tax credit in Canada. Then the Sixth Circuit has affirmed the enforcement of a summons in order to obtain payroll records in a situation where an employment service, a PEO, a professional employment organization, was really trying to scam the IRS for unpaid payroll taxes by transferring their customers and all their records to a new entity when the old entity owed the IRS a lot of money. That's a battle going on in the Sixth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit has affirmed an estate's liability for a late filing penalty, finding that the executor was responsible for knowing what the filing deadline was. And you can't rely on the CPA for the filing deadline. In this case, the CPA made a mistake. We'll talk a little bit about how the nature of the form itself could lead you to make a mistake. And then finally, a letter from the Texas Society of CPAs questioning whether or not the new repair regulations were developed with enough thought about how small business operates. So we have a lot to do. Let's get busy. Internal Legal Memorandum 2013-13-020 holds that a book publisher's activities are not qualified for the domestic production activity deduction. The taxpayer is a publisher of books. They develop print specifications that include the type of paper, the page sizes, the type of printing process, the type of ink. They do market research, resource planning. They do the content and the layout development and the editing. Then they create an electronic version of the book, an electronic master, containing an exact electronic display of each page. That is transmitted to a contract manufacturer who actually produces the books in great quantity. The contract manufacturer uses the electronic version of the book to create printing plates, with which they then use to print the books. Some books they ship to the publisher, others they skip directly to the publisher's customers. The taxpayer goes on to claim that design, development, and creation of and materials analysis and selection and, and repackaging of the books that are sent to them for shipment to their customers constitute manufacturing production activities for purposes of Code Section 199, they lose on all counts. The entity that actually does the production, that combines the raw materials into a finished product, is the entity that's going to qualify for the Section 199 qualified domestic production deduction. And then an electronic communication, an email from the Chief Counsel's Office, 2013-13-028. The subject here is the requirement to issue Forms 1099 for condemnation payments, and the issue is under which code section and what should the 1099 say. The agency requesting the ruling is a Department of Transportation, which takes property under eminent domain and then pays condemnation proceeds to the owner. They're currently using a Form 1099 miscellaneous and reporting the condemnation awards as miscellaneous income. The IRS, and that's, they believe that that's under Code Section 6041. The IRS says, no, it's not Code Section 6041, it's Code Section 6045E, and the agency must issue a Form 1099-S reflecting the entire cash payments to the recipients unless either the transaction or the recipient is exempt from the reporting requirement. The Department of Transportation is required to solicit the taxpayer identification numbers of the persons who receive the money, who transfer the property to the Department of Transportation, and the IRS goes on to explain that where a transfer of real property is involved, the Form 1099-S is the appropriate form. And oh, by the way, the Form 1099-S must include the entire amount of gross proceeds, including the expenses incurred by the transferor as legal expenses. So if the agency pays legal expenses of the entity transferring the property to the state, that must be included as consideration. Next, we have the AIG decision, this coming from the United States District Court for the Southern District of New York. It is appealable, and we need to know this, it is appealable to the Second Circuit, which is important when we look at the authority which is cited by the district court. A brief description of the transactions involved. In each transaction, AIG sold a foreign lender bank preferred shares in a foreign AIG Financial Products Corporation, a special purpose vehicle, and committed to repurchase those shares after a term of years for the original price paid by the lender bank. Capitalized primarily from the sale of those shares, the special purpose vehicle then purchased investments which generated a steady income. The special purpose vehicle paid taxes on the investment income in the foreign jurisdiction and distributed much of the net proceeds to the lender as a tax-free dividend because the tax authority in the lender's jurisdiction considered the lender's purchase of the preferred stock to be an equity investment and there was no tax on dividends to the lender in that jurisdiction. On its 1997, this is a long-running battle, U.S. tax return, AIG claimed foreign tax credits for the full amount of foreign tax paid by the special purpose vehicle, which exceeded AIG's U.S. tax owed on the transactions, allowing it to apply portions of the credits to its tax liability on income from other transactions. And AIG had a theory about how the whole thing ought to be put together. $48 million on the line here. The court says as follows. The government claims the tax benefits generated the spread profit, which AIG claims was the profit on the transaction. According to the government, AIG and the lender effectively shifted tax liability from the foreign bank to the special purpose vehicle, thereby allowing the lender to receive its return as a tax-exempt dividend, and AIG to claim foreign tax credits and interest deductions to offset much of the foreign tax paid by the special purpose vehicle. Those tax savings permitted AIG to negotiate a dividend rate lower than the return on the investment. So AIG, through this complex scheme, borrows money because they're paying, because we've converted what would have been taxable interest to the bank, we've converted that to a tax-free dividend. AIG pays a lesser amount than they're actually earning on the money they borrowed. And they're trying to claim a foreign tax credit on the basis of the amount of money that they earned. The government argues that the transactions lacked economic substance. It cannot be said with reason to have purpose, substance, or utility apart from their anticipated tax consequences. That's the definition of a lacking of economic substance, and the district court cites Lee versus Commissioner, a decision of the Second Circuit to which this case would be appealable, rendered in 1998. Now, this transaction back in 1997 predates Code Section 77010, the codification of the economic substance doctrine. So I've got this item in this week's program to remind everyone that the economic substance doctrine was a judicial doctrine long before it was codified into the Internal Revenue Code, and it is applicable to years before it became part of the Internal Revenue Code. Next, a final report on retirement plan questionnaires sent out in 2008 by the Internal Revenue Service on the activities of the composition of 401k plans. The information was solicited from small plans with 0 to 5 participants, medium plans, 6 to 100, large plans, 101 to 2,500, and very large plans, more than 2,500 participants. And the statistics were developed for each plan level. For example, the report explains, with respect to elective deferrals and employee after-tax contributions, that from 2006 to 2008, 58% of 401k plans experienced a per-participant increase in the dollar amount of elective deferrals, but only 52% experienced a per-participant, but at the same time, 52% of plans experienced a per-participant decrease in the percentage of compensation deferred. So more than half of participants increased the dollar amount of their elective deferral, but more than half of participants decreased their elective deferral as a percentage of compensation. The majority of 401k plan sponsors correct excess contributions within 2.5 months following the end of the excess year. More than 3/4 of the plan sponsors correct non-discrimination testing failures by distributing excess aggregate contributions. 43% of Section 401k plans are safe harbor plans. Small plans are more likely than medium-large or very large plans to be safe harbor plans, and medium plans are more likely than large or very large plans to be safe harbor plans. So smaller plans are more likely to take advantage of the safe harbor provisions. 72% of 401k plans provide involuntary cash outs for small balances. Very large plans are more likely than small or medium plans to allow involuntary cash outs. 62% of Section 401k plans permit in-service withdrawals. And again, both very large and large plans are more likely than both small and medium plans to permit those in-service withdrawals. Well, these statistics and scores more result from that statistical analysis based on 1,200 survey questions that have been through significant analysis. The 50 pages of content in the report and 12 pages of footnotes explaining the sample size for each significant representation in the report. A quick item, the IRS has released 2013 allowable living expense standards, national standards for food, clothing, and other items, national standards for a minimum allowance for out-of-pocket health care, maximum allowances for housing and utilities and transportation based on regional location. Something that I want to make sure everyone understands is that if the IRS determines that a taxpayer's facts and circumstances are such that the national standards are inadequate to provide for basic living expenses, the IRS will allow for actual expenses. Taxpayers must, however, provide documentation that supports that gives the IRS ability to make that determination that using the national and local expense standards leaves an inadequate amount of money for the taxpayer to meet basic living expenses. You may download the national collection standards from the IRS website in a PDF format. Just one last thing before we leave that topic. The 6-year rule for repayment of tax liability. The collection financial standards are used by the IRS in cases requiring financial analysis to determine a taxpayer's ability to pay. Most installment agreements are streamlined agreements that don't require a lot of financial analysis. In those cases where the taxpayer cannot full pay, and those cases that do not meet the criteria for a streamlined agreement, your client may still qualify for this 6-year rule. The six-year rule allows for payment of living expenses that exceed the collection financial standards and allows for other expenses, such as minimum payments on student loans or credit cards, so long as the tax liability, including penalty and interest, can be full paid in no more than 6 years or 72 months. And for some of our clients who are willing to pay what they owe but just need time to pay it, taking advantage of the six-year plan, the streamlined agreement is very much the thing to do. Next, Muhammad Hassanipour and his wife didn't quite understand the tax law. Although he claimed to have studied it thoroughly and spent a lot of time, he made a couple of classic mistakes, and one which you may find amusing. During 2008, Muhammad was employed as a full-time research associate, expected to work 40 hours a week. He turned in timesheets claiming that he worked 1,936 hours. During the year, he also owned 28 rental apartment units in 7 fourplex buildings in Vallejo, California. He had a 50% interest in a single-family residence in Lake Tahoe. He performed various duties relating to the rental properties, including repairs, administrative tasks, communicating with tenants, etc. On his joint return with his spouse for 2008, he and his wife reported wages of $239,000 and claimed net rental losses of $120,000. They did not, however, elect to aggregate all interest in rental real estate as a single rental real estate activity, which would have been fatal had they not had more fatal difficulties. When called upon to support the number of hours he worked on his apartments, the taxpayer claimed he only worked 1,536 hours for his employer, a variance of 400 hours. Now, I suppose the employer might be interested in that discrepancy, but for our purposes, the judge said, okay, so you only worked 1,536 hours. You lied to your employer. I guess we might wonder if you're lying to the court. The judge didn't mention that, but he was, as you'll see in a moment. Muhammad presented estimates, summaries, and a generic calendar, which, although it purported to give his time spent during 2008, was copyrighted in 2009. And Muhammad claimed that he kept contemporaneous records during 2008 on a calendar that wasn't copyrighted until 2009. He recorded 1,182.9, very, very meticulous, total hours on the calendar. He did not keep a contemporaneous record of time spent in relation to the Lake Tahoe property. Now, we all know there's an exception to the rule that rentals are inherently passive, and we know that it's possible to be a real estate professional. In this case, Muhammad did not establish, to the satisfaction of the court, that he was a real estate professional. I quote, "Because we are not persuaded that petitioner spent more time on any or all of his rental activities in 2008 than he spent working for his employer, he has not established that he's a real estate professional. His rental activities, therefore, are per se passive, and he may not offset the losses against other income. So we need not analyze whether he materially participated in the management of the rental properties." The court went on to uphold the assessment of a 20% accuracy penalty. Next, we have two letters addressing different aspects of Code Section 1411, the new 3.8% Medicare tax. In the first letter, Jesse Palmer, a partner in BKD, writes on behalf of the firm, expressing concern that the proposed regulations do not deal with sufficient specificity the application of Section 1411 to income from grouped real estate activities, nor do they adequately address real estate professionals and the concept of the real estate professional as conducting an active trade or business. A Canadian firm, Moody's Gartner, is concerned that the 3.8% tax paid to the United States government would not come under the authority, would not be a creditable tax in Canada. Here's the problem. A foreign tax credit is granted under the Internal Revenue Code, which states, "The amount of taxes imposed by foreign countries and possessions of the U.S. shall be allowed as a credit against the tax imposed by this chapter, to the extent provided in Section 901. The words "this chapter" refer to Chapter 1 of the Internal Revenue Code, which spans Sections 1 through 1400U. But 14:11 appears in new chapter 2a. So it isn't in chapter 1, and we either need, it appears that we need to fix the wording of code section 27 to encompass both chapter 1 and chapter 2a. In United States versus AS Holdings Group, LLC, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals orders enforcement of an IRS administrative summons for the records of a payroll company to aid the IRS in its investigation of a professional employer organization that went out of business owing significant amounts to the IRS and apparently transferred its clients and its personnel to a newly organized entity which was using the same payroll service. The moral to the story, I suppose, could be expressed very simply as you can run, but you cannot hide. Next, Peter Knapp, an executor of an estate because he was a friend of the deceased, went to his longtime accountant, a man that he trusted implicitly, for help with the estate tax return. The first advice Mr. Knapp got from his accountant, Mr. Burns, that the tax return would be due 9 months from the date of the decedent's death was perfectly accurate. But at some point before that deadline, Mr. Knapp realized he didn't have time to get everything done, and so he went to Mr. Burns and asked if there was a possibility of an extension. Mr. Burns said, yes, we'll fill out a Form 4768, an application for extension of time to file a return and or pay U.S. estate or generation skipping transfer taxes. Now, the Form 4768 gives taxpayers three options. They can, number one, they can seek an extension of the Form 706 filing deadline. Number two, they can seek an extension of the time to pay any estate tax due, or both. The instructions, however, offer a 6-month extension for time to file and a 12-month extension for time to pay. So the periods of extension are different, and Mr. Burns missed that. Even though the IRS approved the extension request in writing and returned a copy of the Form 4768 to Burns with a notation handwritten 22807, somehow Burns and Knapp still believed that they had until August 30th, 2007 to file the return. When Burns prepared the return, he mistakenly believed that it was possible to request a 12-month extension. Now, can Mr. Knapp, because he relied on Mr. Burns' mistaking belief, can he avoid the penalty for late filing his friend's estate tax return? The answer, regrettably, no. When you have the responsibility for signing and filing a return, you have a personal obligation to determine the filing deadline. You can take the accountant's advice about a lot of other things, but not about the due date of the return. Finally, a group of Texas certified public accountants calls to the IRS's attention that the new repair regulations create administrative burdens for small businesses, and they use a couple of examples. In the first example, the taxpayer, small business taxpayer, runs a bakery, and there are several bakery lines. The concern expressed by the Texas CPAs is that each bakery line has probably been considered as a unit of property by the taxpayer, but the new regulations would require the taxpayer to break down that line, the mixing bowl, the oven, the cooling rack. All those would be required to be treated as separate units of property under the new regulations, and a small business taxpayer just doesn't have those records. In the second example, the Texas CPAs called to the IRS's attention example of a real estate developer that owns 20 apartment projects with an average cost per apartment of $40,000, and the taxpayer does not have an applicable financial statement, which they point out is a problem with a lot of small business taxpayers, and so would not qualify for the de minimis rule and would just have a heck of a time going back and reconstructing the costs to break down what they had thought was one unit of property into several units of property. As you recall, the new regulations specify as separate units of property the heating, ventilating, and air conditioning, the plumbing, the electrical. They leave only the building shell as a separate unit of property. Well, that's a lot of material. It's a little bit long program today. Thanks for staying with me. Thanks for joining me every week. And as always, stay safe.